From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Just about every day on The Howard Stern Show, Artie Lang tells hilarious stories, usually about his biggest problems, like drinking, overeating, and his love life. How has reliving his most humiliating experiences for the entertainment of Howard's audience changed his life? That's just one of the things we'll talk about with Artie on today's Fresh Air. Artie Lang is a comic and actor and cast member of The Howard Stern Show. He co-wrote and stars in the new movie comedy Beer League. Also today, Maureen Corrigan reviews Alice McDermott's new book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of us at Fresh Air are fans of The Howard Stern Show, and we know many of our listeners are too. We think that he uses the medium of radio brilliantly with the help of his regular cast of characters. One of them is my guest, Artie Lang. Lang is a comic and actor. Since joining The Howard Stern Show in 2001, he's become famous for his hilarious stories, which are usually about his biggest problems, like drinking, overeating, gambling, and his on-again, off-again relationship with his girlfriend, who now seems to be his ex-girlfriend. Artie was an original cast member of the sketch comedy show Mad TV and was on the ABC sitcom Norm. He's appeared in the films Dirty Work, The Bachelor, Old School, and Elf. Artie Lang co-wrote and stars in the new movie comedy Beer League. The film is about a group of guys in New Jersey whose softball team is in the league playoffs. For them, softball is more about drinking beer and goofing off than playing ball. How close is the character you play in Beer League to you?
Too close. This would be me if I didn't get lucky and get into show business. I would be exactly this guy. Unfortunately, I'd be, you know, by the time I was this age, probably a raging alcoholic playing in a softball league that I took way too seriously and probably living with my mother. That sounds like an accurate description.
Tell me a story from the movie that actually comes from your real life.
You know, these leagues are all, they call them beer leagues. They should really call them hard liquor leagues. The drinking is just such a part of the softball culture before, sometimes during, and after a game. I played in a league where every base was a quarter keg of beer, and you had a cup in your back pocket. If you got on base, you filled up. And I don't know who in the town committee allowed this to happen, but within 2 weeks they had to get rid of the league because people were just drunk by the second inning, throwing bats, and it was violent. And the fight in the film, the old guy on our team, played by Seymour Cassell, he has a line in the movie where he tells the one kid to hold another guy's head while he tries to kick him. That really happened. I played in a league where a guy who's about 78 years old who was our pitcher, and a brawl busted out, and he told my friend on our team to hold a kid's head while he tried to kick him, and he went to kick him, and he grabbed his gut, and he fell down. We thought he had a heart attack. So it's basically the fight in the movie is based on several different fights that actually happened.
You're the lead in your new movie. You co-wrote it, you star in it, you have a girlfriend in it. It's about you. You're not like the friend of the lead.
Right. So I played the best friend a lot.
So are there things you were able to write for yourself that other people haven't written for you? In terms of having situations that you want to play?
Yeah, well, it's funny. Like, the parts I played in other movies, I would just get to come in and do funny stuff. I was in a movie called The Bachelor with Renee Zellweger and Chris O'Donnell. That was probably the biggest studio film that I had ever been in that I had a big part in. And I was a little more than just the guy to come in for comic relief like I was in Dirty Work or this other thing I did, Lost and Found. I had a wife in that movie. And that was a different thing for me, having a romantic interest that you had to sort of, you know, have a real moment with that's not about comedy, you know. It's like, it's hard for me in real life, and playing it on screen with a total stranger was totally foreign to me. But as the lead, see, I just like doing jokes. I don't care about the other stuff that isn't funny, but you need the other stuff to make a complete movie. So as the lead, you have to handle all of the exposition in the film, not just the jokes, the storyline, and some of the romantic stuff and the more sappy stuff that sets up the comedy, the stuff that's sappy that makes you a more sympathetic character and a more likable guy to get away with the funny stuff. So I never really had to do any of that in a movie. A lot of my dialogue in this movie is exposition to move the story along because I'm the guy it's about. And I have a serious girlfriend in the film, and that's really covered. I gave myself a hot chick. I always say that You know, once people see the girl in the movie that plays my girlfriend that I get, they're gonna think it's in the science fiction section, not the comedy section. But, you know, I gave myself a hot chick, and there's scenes where, you know, I have to have dinner with her, and it's not jokes. It's really like, okay, these two guys getting to know each other and, you know, trying to be sentimental, and that all helps you get away with the comedy. It sets up the comedy. I hated doing that. The director had to really keep me focused to get through the serious, sappy stuff. But watching how he put it together, he was so right. It really makes you like the two characters and feel for them and care about them, and it makes every other part of the movie work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic and actor Artie Lang from The Howard Stern Show. He's got a new movie that he co-wrote and stars in. It's called Beer League. Now, the first time you were on Howard Stern Show was as a guest with Norm Macdonald. You and he were promoting a movie.
Right.
You were really funny on it. How did you go from being a guest to being part of the regular cast of characters?
Well, that appearance was to promote a film called Dirty Work. And Norm knew how big of a fan of the Stern Show I was. He was going in to promote the film. He said, hey, why don't you come with me and maybe, you know, Howard will have you on. And Norm at the time was going through kind of a crazy separation, sort of divorce, and he didn't want to deal with that. And Howard, you know, always asked those personal questions. So Norm said, hey, if that happens, I'll bring you in and we'll talk about the movie. So sure enough, a minute into Norm's interview, that happened. And they bring me in, and as they're putting the headset on me, Norm says to Howard on the air, and I did not know he was going to do this. He said, Howard, you'll love Artie. He got kicked off of Mad TV because of cocaine. And I on the air, I just like looked at him like, what the hell did you just say? And Howard, of course, darted his eyes right to me. And I told this whole story about getting arrested and almost getting fired and going to rehab. And, of course, Howard loved that. He loved stories like that. So he said to Norm, bring Artie back when you come back and we'll hear more stories like that. We went back in three more times to promote a sitcom we were doing together called Norm. And every time I went in, I would tell another crazy story, and Howard always loved it. And when the Norm show got canceled, it was, again, one of those things in life, perfect timing. It was a coincidence. Jackie Martling, the comedian who was on the show for years, left the show, and they were looking for another guy. So Howard remembered me from going in with Norm several times. And 2 months later, they whittled it down to a couple of guys, and then eventually I got offered the job.
Now, you know how you're saying Norm Macdonald brought you on because he didn't want to answer the personal questions that he knew Howard would ask?
Right.
You're asked those questions all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just anything about, you know, drugs, sex, your
right.
girlfriend or your ex-girlfriend, depending on what day it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you ready for that? Are you comfortable with that? Are there ever kind of consequences?
Yes, absolutely. It's my fault. Before anybody takes the blame for that, I would have to. I offered it up from the very beginning. I was always sort of honest about my life and the bad parts as well as the good parts. And now, you know, I'm just known for being so honest that it's almost expected of me to just come clean and say everything. There are lines I won't cross. Dating someone, that's a fine sort of that's a difficult road to go down. And I found the boundaries as we went along. There's a story about a hooker that ripped me off in Las Vegas for $500 that I told him off the air. And on the air, he just brought it up, and he said, come on, tell the story, and he ended up getting it out of me. It happened before I was dating my girlfriend, but we were dating at the time he got me to tell the story, so it was a very sensitive thing. She was like, I can't believe you told that story, and I said, well, it was before you. She goes, yeah, but it's still embarrassing, and so stuff like that has happened.
Now, listeners know that your girlfriend or now ex-girlfriend?
Right now, unfortunately, it's ex-girlfriend, yes.
Yeah, well, she had always wanted you to go into therapy. You right. got a lot of issues with
definitely.
Gambling, drugs, alcohol, food, other things.
Every self-destructive thing, yeah.
yeah. So she wanted you to go into therapy. You've always avoided therapy. Now, my producer, Amy, pointed out that being on Howard's show is almost like therapy in the sense that you're always talking about yourself, telling stories about yourself.
Yes.
And Howard's always like forcing you to go deeper and deeper. But then my producer, Phyllis, pointed out that although the talk part might sound like therapy, therapy expects you to change. But on Howard's show, it's kind of like you're rewarded for that kind of behavior because
absolutely.
If you can get a good story out of it, that's all anybody wants.
Yeah, no, that's very perceptive of both of them, actually. Yeah, you know, it's weird. A lot of comics, actually Andrew Dice Clay, who I met through the show and worked with once, would say, what do you want to go to therapy for? The fact that you're so screwed up in the head is why you're funny. You know, why would you want to fix that? And in a way, it makes sense. I guess all comics, at least the most of them that I know, could probably use a good dose of therapy. And a lot of them are reluctant because they feel in some way maybe it'll lose their edge and their crazy view of life and why they're funny. And that sounds a little ridiculous to me, but maybe deep down I really do feel that way.
But Howard's been in therapy for very intensive therapy.
Absolutely.
For a long
well, he
time.
Says on the air, he goes, yeah, 4 times a week. That's a lot.
Yeah, you know, when I think about that, I think, okay, he spends most of the day talking about himself on the show. And then he goes to therapy and talks about himself off the air.
Yes, yes. He's interested in himself. Absolutely.
But have you seen the therapy change him? I mean, when you look at him, do you think, well, therapy takes the edge out of comedy?
Well, personally, I can't comment on that because I didn't know Howard
before the therapy.
As a fan of the show, it's a much different show from years ago when he was a married guy, sort of miserable, not in therapy. But it's just as good, but in a different way. And I think it proves that he's just an amazing broadcaster. He could sort of get the life he has now of a multi-millionaire who's an icon, dating a gorgeous model and living the lifestyle he lives, you know, limos all over the place. But he's still able to relate to everybody because, he's just a brilliant communicator. It's just from a different angle now, you know. He's saying, guess what, guys? I used to be that guy who you could relate to, but now I'm a guy who was that guy and got all these things that a lot of people dream of, and I'm telling you what it's like, you know, when you get it.
But in a way, it's your job now to be that guy that everybody can relate to.
I think a lot of people think that, and that was not an intentional thing. It's amazing. People have so many theories about the show, like, oh, Howard hired you so you could be the regular guy on the show to relate to the blue-collar regular guy. And it's not that calculated. It just turns out that I happen to be a guy who is a bit of a blue-collar slob, and I inherited that that role on the show. It's definitely the regular guy sort of viewpoint is definitely what seems to be my role on the show, but that's not an intentional thing.
My guest is Artie Lang. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Artie Lang. He's a cast member of The Howard Stern Show. One of your most famous stories from The Howard Stern Show is back when you were a regular on Mad TV, the sketch comedy
right.
show, and you were doing a lot of cocaine at the time. And you were very high and totally lacking in sleep. I think it had been like 4 days without sleep at
yes.
this point. So the story, it's a really long and very funny kind of tragic story.
Yeah.
About how you ended up punching one of the producers and then fleeing from the cops because they had called the cops on you.
Right.
Fleeing from the cops, and then you end up punching one of the cops and he finds cocaine on you, so you're arrested for assaulting an officer and possessing cocaine. Okay, great story. People on Howard Stern really loved it. What's it like when you're working with Howard and Robin and say you don't show up? Say you've—I don't know if you're still getting high, whatever. Right. But say something not quite as out of control like that happens in the context of their show. Do they think it's so funny?
Well, first of all, no. I stopped doing cocaine. I had to. The last time I did coke, and from going to rehab, everybody remembers dates. June the 14th, 1997 is the last hit of blow I did, thank God, because that was just killing me. I still drink, and a lot of people say, well, how can you do one without the other? I've been able to do it, thank God. And look, I've had coke put in my hand on the road at gigs, and I'm able to just throw it away. I just look at it like death, the devil. But last year, I had a lot of stress. I was traveling to promote a DVD and my stand-up comedy, and I did 6 months on the road while I was doing the show at the same time, weekend gigs, and then I was going into shooting this film Beer League, and I was really, really stressed, and I was drinking a lot on the road. And when I got back from Chicago last June, the week after the gig, in between the road and shooting the movie, I sort of had a breakdown to where I couldn't get to work, and I've suffered through depressions. And I think it all stems from addictions. I think my depression was caused by the drugs I was using way back when, and I think the alcohol that I was consuming on the road and just the stress of traveling and the strain caused me to go into this depression. And I couldn't, when I go into these depressions, it's insane. I like people say, I get depressed sometimes too, but it's a different kind of thing. And anyone who suffered from this will know what I'm talking about. It just stays on you like a wet blanket. You physically can't move. You're so out of it. You can't function. You can't shave. And like I went through one of these, episodes, you know, last year, and I couldn't make it to the show for 4 days. Now, it was way more amplified publicly at this point because I'm more famous now, and the Stern Show is obviously a high-profile thing. And in the context of the show, he just made a joke about it. You know, it's just it's a tragic thing, I guess, but you know, it's a comedy show and a lot of the material is dark and it's based on our real life. So when I got back after missing 4 days, I got teased and reamed and everything else by the callers, by him, and I never stopped it. I just took it because If you take it, you're able to also dish it out. And I wanted to prove to myself that I had a thick skin and could deal with it. So I dealt with it, and after a few days, it went away. If I had told him, look, this is a serious issue, and we shouldn't really handle it this way on the air, believe me, he would respect that. That's how he is. But I never did that. I said, to hell with it. I'm going to go in and fess up to what happened and just deal with it. And that's what I did. And eventually it went away, you know.
Well, getting back to that similarity between being on the show and being in therapy. although you're not in therapy, when you go through a really bad depression like that, and then you come on the show and everybody's kind of ribbing you for it, and you're talking about it, and they're talking about it, and the callers are talking about it.
Yeah.
What does it help or hurt in terms of your own emotional inner life?
I don't know. You see, I created a sort of a monster on the show with this bit that I do where I go like this. If somebody's complaining about something, I'll say, wah, I do this thing where, you know, the whining wah thing. And that became a bit that I did for like a year on the show. And then, of course, as soon as I got back, the first caller hits me with, wah, I'm depressed, wah, I got to make a movie, and I'm stressed out, wah. So, and on the I mean, I have created, God forbid, if I ever died, some of these crazy fans would show up to my wake and go up to my mother and go, wah, my fat son died, wah. they're that nuts. So, look, I sat there and I said to myself, I dish it out and I got to take this. And I'm doing okay now. Maybe it helped, but I don't know. I have never really figured out in a really deep, sort of thorough way what causes that in my head. I mean, obviously, therapy would...
I was going to point that out.
Therapy would help that, but I'm still reluctant to go, and the only therapy I get is on national radio. So maybe I'm a human experiment. We'll see if it's working or not.
Do you ever want to say to your fans when you're really depressed or unhappy... if like you meet a fan in the street or something like this, it's right. Not funny right now. Just like go away.
Yeah, there's times I want to, but again, radio fame is such a different kind of fame than anything else. I've been lucky enough to have success in a lot of different areas like movies and television. But when you're yourself on the radio, being honest, people really feel when they see you that you're their friend. You know, this is the guy that I drive to work with every morning and who tells me all these crazy stories about himself. And I love that relationship. I love it. I think it's so special. So I treat them like a friend. If they come up to me on the street and I'm a little bit of a bad mood, I'll suck it up and try to be nice and friendly and say hi the same way I would a friend. And it's weird. They know about my life, and they ask. And a lot of times, again, they're right on the money. They're very perceptive, and that's touching to me. It's very, it's a unique thing. So there's times where I feel like saying something, but I don't.
Artie Lang will be back in the second half of the show. He's a cast member of The Howard Stern Show and the star of the new movie, Beer League. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential. The Black Dahlia, in theaters tomorrow. From the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, working to make cancer a national priority at Celebration on the Hill. Details at acscan.org. And from Dell Books, publisher of The Sacred Cut, a modern mystery set in Rome by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's Artie Lang showing off one of his lesser talents. Coming up, we talk more about his life on and off Howard Stern Show, and Maureen Carrigan reviews Alice McDermott's new novel.
I got it!
Artie, you do it.
Come on, whacking double time on the seduction line. She was one of a kind. She's just a line. Oh my, wanted no applause. Just another cause. Made a meal out of me and come back home. Had to cool me down to take another round. Now I'm back in the ring to take another swing. Come the wild one shaking, the earth one shaking. Mine was aching.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Artie Lang. He's a comic and actor, best known as a cast member of The Howard Stern Show. He co-wrote and stars in the new movie comedy, Beer League. Let's pick up where we left off. You know how you were saying that you fear, like, if you died, a fan would come to your funeral and say to your mother, wow, my fat son died.
Right, yeah. Right.
So there's actually a website, I know you know about this, That's called Artie Lang Death Watch.
Yes.
And it's headlined, "We are very concerned about the health and well-being of comedian, actor, and Howard Stern Show regular Artie Lang. This site will be dedicated to monitoring changes in Artie's health, eating habits, and general sloth." And the website explains that they love you.
Right.
They're not wishing you ill. They're just monitoring you.
They love me,
you.
Yeah.
So what's your reaction to seeing that? Is it creepy?
Yeah, it's a little creepy. It's a little bit of a wake-up call, too. My mother hates it. You know, we're living in a time where, you know, this Google thing, you meet somebody out at a bar and they immediately Google your name. And with me, I'm thinking, like, you know, now I might be going into the single life again. If I meet a girl at a bar who doesn't really know who I am and Googles my name, one of the first things she's going to see is a website predicting my early death, the other one with a pool about when I'll die, and that's got to freak a person out. It would freak me out. Actually, I got life insurance canceled because of that website.
No,
yeah,
really?
Absolutely. The guy, the insurance agent, you know, did a search for me on the internet and saw that's one of several websites that actually predict maybe an early death for me. I outlived them. I think the earliest they had me going was 36 when I started on the show, so I'm 38 now. But what they'll do is, like, they'll come to my stand-up show and count the drinks I had. And try to see what I ate, like they'll put it on the website. They'll say, "Look, you know, Artie had, you know, 10 Jack and Waters at the show the other night. He had 2 chicken parmesan sandwiches, and so I think you know, this week he really put a couple of nails in the coffin." They'll listen to the show and hear what I ate that morning. Sometimes Howard will make me go over what I ate. My menu's a big feature on the show, and they'll list it on that website. They'll update it day to day what I ate, which is very creepy. You know, what am I? We're living in the age of the internet. Again, I just got to deal with it. If it really bugged me, I guess I would get into another profession. But I don't know. I guess I'm fine with it.
Well, my theory is when you meet women who know you, that there's like 2 main categories. One
right.
would be, "You're a pig, I hate you." And the other would be, "You're really funny, I love you, and I'm going to heal you, I'm going to change you."
Yes.
No other woman could, but I will.
Right, I think I'm a project for some women. And yeah, there's a lot of women out there who feel like it's a challenge almost, and they almost get that motherly thing where I can take care of this guy and change him, and I don't know. I thought I met that woman 4 years ago, but I screwed that up, I guess. It would be...
You're going through a breakup live on the air.
Yes, yes, I know. And it does, like actually the last couple of days, it was really made sort of official that this is, it looks like it's not gonna continue. And I'm very sad. I definitely hurting inside about it, and... at the same time, you got to be funny for 5 hours. But what makes me really depressed about it is I'm realizing that, if I was a better man, I think we would still be together, maybe even married now. And I also genuinely wish her happiness. Like, I don't think I could ever truly be happy knowing Dana was sad. So I really do love her, but I also realize that... I would just be wrong for her. I don't think I'm capable of changing the way she would need me to change. And that's depressing, you know.
My guest is Artie Lang. He's a regular on Howard Stern Show. He's a comic and actor, and he has a new movie that he stars in and co-wrote, and it's called Beer League. What are the preparations like for the show?
The lack of preparation early in the morning. I always thought that, you know, Howard got there at like... 4:45 and got bits together and you know, every newspaper article he wanted to talk about was out, and he gets a lot of that done at home through the use of a computer now with everybody, and Like the first time I showed up, I got there at 20 to 6, and I'm sitting there. I wanted to make sure I was early. I'm like, where's Howard? Where's Howard? He walked in at like 3 minutes to 6, said hi to me. Gary went over a couple of minor things with him, and he went right on the air. So I got used to that. The preparation for me is, I mean, I have the dream job. I have no preparation. Like, all my work is what you hear me say on the air. I'll try to read the New York Post, page 6, because that's probably the part of a newspaper that he'll refer to the most. So I'll try to get familiar with that real quick in the morning over a cup of coffee. And then I like it this way because it sounds more conversational. I genuinely have no idea what he's going to bring up. And my job is just to roll with the punches, whatever the subject is, and try to add humor to it. And it's been working so far. I like the spontaneity. I don't like to be overly prepared for anything.
Let me ask you something about the show that I just want your impression of this. Sometimes I think that some of the more like homophobic humor mm-hmm. on the show and misogynist humor on the show, it's like when you're doing it on the show, I could see you guys are really funny. And even when things rub me the wrong way,
right.
You're pros. You're good at what you do. You're all brilliant at what you do. But then I wonder about the people listening who, you know, if they think like, hey, it's really cool to be homophobic, or it's right. like really cool to just have girls who are strippers and to think of all girls as strippers. Do you worry about that at all?
Yes, to a certain extent. I'd be lying if I said I don't worry about it. But to me, the people you're describing are dumb people, you know. The Howard Stern Show is a big hit because it entertains dumb and smart people at the same time for different reasons. And there's a couple of shows like that. The Simpsons is another one. Smart people and stupid people love The Simpsons for totally different reasons. That's why it's a big hit. Everybody's either smart or stupid, so a lot of people watch it.
Yeah.
Our show, smart people and stupid people love it for different reasons. And early on in my career, I sort of just made a commitment to myself. I refuse to cater to stupid people. What we do on the air is just try to be funny and hope that the smart people listen more than the dumb people.
How do you feel about the part of the show where people become regulars because of a physical deformity, like a mental problem?
Right.
You're comfortable with that part?
You know, again, there's times where it's heartbreaking to see some of the people come in and get on the air and speak about their lives. This is a very difficult subject because the one argument is you're giving some sort of wonderful gift to these people that they're becoming sort of mini celebrities. Like
right.
Beetlejuice is an example of a guy. He's a a retarded black midget who you know, drinks all the time, and he's got bad teeth, and the guy's a rock star. He makes over six figures a year doing appearances because the show made him famous. And I really think he's having a good time with it. You know, he seems happy. He seems to like the attention and all the party and everything, whereas without that, his life would be, you know, lonely and pathetic and everything. Now, that's me sort of justifying what we do. You know, that's the positive argument. He could go home and have really, really dark, dark times thinking about, they're laughing at me and I'm being exploited and, he gets paid a lot of money and there's people that handle him. They seem to be good, honest people, and I hope that they take care of him. But look, we don't see him 24 hours a day. He seems to be fine with it. But if I knew that one of these people that comes on our show all the time was really hurting about it and felt exploited and was sad, to be honest with you, that would really make me upset, and I would question having them on again if that were the case. I genuinely think that the people that come on our show enjoy it, enjoy the attention, and I think it enriches their lives. That would have been, you know, really, really maybe boring, mundane, and you know, for lack of a better word, horrible without all this love. They get a lot of love. You know, Beetlejuice, again, is a guy who was born with this deformity, but when he walks on stage, he gets all that affection. They love him. It's like Elvis, mm-hmm. and I genuinely think he digs it. If I thought he didn't, it would bug me. It really would. And I'd have to be honest about that. I go, look, this kid's miserable doing this. We shouldn't, you know, have him on anymore.
My guest is Artie Lang. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Artie Lang. He's a regular on The Howard Stern Show. He's a comic and actor, and he's co-written and stars in a new movie called Beer League. When you were, well, I forget what year it was, but your father was a contractor. And
he
had
installed
an accident.
Television antennas, yeah.
He had an accident. He fell off the roof.
Yes.
And, had quadriplegia after
right.
that. How did that change your life?
Oh, God. He was my best friend. It was the quintessential father-son sort of American relationship. We played baseball together, and he was everything to me, and I sort of looked at him like Superman. I mean, almost literally, I would go to him to work, and I would go to work with him, and he would be on the roof, and I thought he could fly when I was like 7 years old, literally. And he fell a week after my 18th birthday, and it was like, here's adulthood, like throwing cold water in your face. And it changed my life in the sense that I was a horrible student. I was never going to go to college. I just used that as an extra reason not to go. But I was definitely a lost soul. I knew I wanted to be a comedian, but that seemed like a huge mountain. How was I going to make that happen? And when he fell and we went broke, my mother, you know, he fell off a ladder that he had stolen, and he wasn't even using it properly, and he fell off a house that had no homeowner's insurance. So there's always somebody to sue, usually, so at least you get a settlement. There was nobody to sue. So we had no money saved anyway, and there were doctor bills, and my mother had to go on welfare. I remember driving my mother to the welfare office at 18, and she was a very proud Italian woman, and she hated going through that. And my father was sitting there. He couldn't move. And I used it as an excuse to just go into an insane downward spiral. I mean, every self-destructive thing you could imagine. Drinking, drugs, gambling, you know, overeating, bar fights, getting into fights with guys I knew could kick my ass, bouncers, just because I just wanted to just get in my own dark world and just, you know, sort of wallow in it and just escape. And that was my excuse. That was my why. You know, that was my old man's a quadriplegic, so I deserve to get drunk. And that's when all my addictions really kicked in. So before he fell, I really didn't have those issues. I might have been on the road to them. After he fell, they all kicked in, and I just went. It was the 4 years that he lived after the accident. It's all a blur to me. I can barely remember it.
Did you take any responsibility for taking care of him?
Well, yeah. What happened was because we couldn't afford 24-hour nurses, Medicaid allowed for a nurse 8 hours a day. My mother got a secretarial job. So he had to be turned every couple hours. Otherwise, you get bad bed sores. So if I was home hungover or something, I would turn him and talk to him. And we had these crazy, there's like one-on-one conversations when my mother was at a job as a secretary and my sister was bartending to put herself through college. And it was just me and him in the house. And he's like looking at me like, how did I do this? What happened? And it was just really dark, depressing conversations. And more than once he asked me to kill him. And that had to be like such a hard, you know, to ask his son. He would even say stuff like, you know, he had all these crazy pills, painkillers, which I stole every once in a while to get high. And he would say, look, just leave them on the table. I'll somehow get them in my mouth. You know, like you don't have to shoot me in the head or anything. And that's literally what the conversations were like for 4 years. And I just stayed self-medicated. And I would try to turn them when my mother couldn't. And then I would go out at night and get drunk or whatever, and my mother would literally have to set her alarm for every 2 hours to get up and turn them, and then get up and go to work all day. So I took over some of his accounts, installing antennas, climbing roofs, just because we needed the money so desperately. My mother hated that, but I was capable of doing it. I had learned how to do it through him, so I started installing antennas in the first couple of years after he fell, just to get some immediate money. But of course, my mother was freaked out. Now I'm climbing a roof,
right,
you know.
Right,
so
right.
That's how I tried to help, by doing some work. But I was basically, in those 4 years, no help at all. It's probably why I'm so guilty now, and I try to, I lavish my mother with everything I possibly can, you know.
Your father died 4 years after the accident, and
yeah.
It was after that that you started trying out comedy?
Yeah, the first time I ever tried it, I was 19 years old.
So that's when he was still alive, then.
Yes, July 12th, 1987. I'll never forget that day, because that was the first I had been saying to myself, I got to try this, and I officially got up one day. I read in the paper that the old Improv on 9th Ave and 44th Street was having a lottery. Like 200 people show up. They put 10 pieces of paper. They put a bunch of pieces of paper in a hat. If you get a piece of paper that has a number on it, that's your number that night. So first try, sure enough, on my first time going, people would go constantly and never get a number and have to come back. My first try, I got the number 10. I was 10th in a lineup of 12 guys. I had to go back that night. And I had just told my mother and father that I was going to try to do it. I took my father's handicap van into New York. I parked it on 9th Avenue. I was afraid it was going to get towed. I went into the Milford Plaza and tried out 5 minutes of stuff that I had prepared in my head, and I went up and bombed miserably. But I was proud of myself that I actually did it, you know. So I went home and told him about it, but I had bombed so bad it intimidated me, and I didn't try it again for another 4 years. Until after he died. So I tried it once while he was still alive, and it was a bad experience. Then I went back into the booze, wallowing. I was like, God, this dream of mine didn't work out. Now what am I going to do? I did it once, and I thought I just would always suck when everybody sucks the first time. And it took him dying for me to really go, I'm going to try this again. I'll give it one more shot. So almost in honor of his memory, I'm going to give it another shot. And it felt better that time. And out of lack of anything else to do, I just kept going back, you know.
Do you think your mother's surprised at how you turned out and how successful you are?
I think my mother, in a lot of ways, is surprised I'm alive, much less successful. She always had confidence in me. She was never this old-fashioned sort of Italian mother who would say, no, that's too much of a risk. Get some sort of steady work. Because I worked as, my friend got me a job as a longshoreman right after my father had passed away, unloading ships at the port in Newark. And that's a great job if you didn't go to college. You can make, you know, 80 grand a year with overtime. And I quit. I saved up a few grand, and I quit to try comedy. Now, a lot of mothers would have went, especially old school Italian mothers, would be like, don't quit this job. It's such a great job. She was never like that. She was like, this is your dream. I believe in you. Go try it. So I think she always knew I had it in me, but the level of success I've had, maybe she didn't, you know, sort of predict that, because I've been very lucky, you know.
Well, Artie, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I hope this was all right. I feel like in this atmosphere, you really do, you even pour your heart out more than on Stern, because it's just two people. It's like a one-on-one. It really does feel like a shrink session.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's good. This
so
was,
you're going to go into therapy now?
Maybe. Maybe I'll just keep coming here every day. We could do this. Thank you very much, Terry. This was
thank you very much.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
Artie Lang is a cast member of The Howard Stern Show. He co-wrote and stars in the new movie Beer League. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Alice McDermott's new novel. This is Fresh Air. Writer Alice MacDermott won the National Book Award in 1998 for her novel Charming Billy. MacDermott has just brought out a new novel called After This, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says that it's a stunner.
Critics have genuflected before Alice MacDermott by likening her to James Joyce. Both writers take up Irish Catholics as their subjects, even if MacDermott's are a generation or two removed from the old sod. And both writers are poets who share a particular genius for evoking mood and worldview in a few quick strokes. Apt as that comparison is, however, there are ones closer to home that make just as much sense, to American masters of people and place like William Faulkner and Philip Roth. MacDermott's latest novel, called After This, particularly brings to mind an Irish Catholic version of Roth's epic of the 1960s, American Pastoral. The self-deprecating humor, the guilt, the earnest struggle to stake out their peaceful slice of suburbia on the edges of a roiling New York City. Roth's New Jersey Jews and MacDermott's Long Island Irish Catholics have a lot in common. But enough with comparisons to the big boys of literature. For in After This, an astonishing novel, MacDermott takes off the ladylike white gloves and demonstrates that she's no longer acting like a nice Irish Catholic girl who's going to be flattered by inclusion with the towering likes of Joyce, Faulkner, or Roth. Instead, she's giving these guys a real run for their money. The difference between After This and MacDermott's earlier books is not a matter of literary quality. MacDermott has always been a breathtaking, lyrical writer, but of ambition. In this novel, MacDermott tackles recent American history and indirectly gives pronouncements on sweeping social changes that rip through even small lives. The small lives under scrutiny here are those of the Keene family, John and Mary and their four children, who live in a tightly knit Catholic neighborhood on Long Island. Without melodrama, MacDermott depicts the ruptures in the Keene's coherent lives caused first by the memories of the Depression and World War II, and then in dizzying succession, Vatican Council II, the Vietnam War, the Second Women's Movement and the legalization of abortion, urban decay, and even globalization. MacDermott doesn't plod through these events. Rather, she invokes them in chapters that could almost stand as individual short stories because of their intensity and quick dramatic turns. With wry humor, MacDermott plants a metaphor for the ultimate transformation these historical events and social changes will wreak on the Keene family. Midway through the book, she describes a fundraising effort to build a new church for St. Gabriel's Parish. Replacing the dark, incense-filled church will be a futuristic structure informed by the democratic impulses of Vatican II, a church in the round, like a spaceship. For better and for worse, that's what the 60s do to the Keene family and their friends. Loosen the ties to their faith-bound lives, send them hurtling, weightless, into space. What keeps us readers tethered to the story is MacDermott's great gift for evoking ordinary working people whose reticent demeanors cloak thoughtful and sometimes tortured inner lives. Mary Keene, a single woman of 30 when the novel begins a few years after World War II, has a girlfriend in her office typing pool named Pauline. Pauline is fated to be the spinster honorary aunt to the family Mary goes on to have. And in a phrase, McDermott captures a whole personality type when she remarks about Pauline that she was self-effacing, but that she also wanted the attention such generous self-effacement surely earned her. Similarly, McDermott summons up a lost world of manners when she depicts how Mary, gasping in the throes of premature childbirth on her living room couch, turns her head to greet an unexpected visitor stepping through the front door. "It was simply what you did," writes McDermott. "You made conversation in elevators, complimented small children in strollers, looked up from your magazine to greet the stranger who took the seat beside you on a bus. You said with simple friendliness, 'That's a lovely hat,' or 'Isn't it cold?' because it was another way of saying, 'Here we are, all of us, more or less in the same boat.' It was the habit of friendliness, a lifetime of it." I wish I could quote this whole novel to have the pleasure of immediately rereading it again, especially to catch the foreshadowing remarks and images I surely missed the first time around. After this begins with a doozy of such a foreshadowing scene. The 30-year-old Mary Keene in church on her lunch hour, despairing of finding a husband, praying to God to at least grant her contentment. That seems at first like a humble prayer a good Catholic would utter. But by the end of this splendid novel about the world turned upside down, it seems like way too much to ever have asked for.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed After This by Alice McDermott. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia, from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, in theaters tomorrow. And from Hollywood Records, presenting Indigo Girls' new album, Despite Our Differences, available in stores September 19th. More information at indigogirls.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As soon as you're born.
On the next Fresh Air, John Lennon's secret FBI files and historian John Wiener's 14-year battle to gain access to them. Wiener wrote a book about those FBI files and is a consultant for the new documentary, The U.S. versus John Lennon. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
You feel nothing at all. A working class hero.